This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear the story of a young couple with troubled pasts stumbling into a fatal confrontation at a Bloomington trailer park. Was it murder?
In the legal field, a lot of skepticism about how beneficial the rule is. And typically, prosecutors like it.
GLT and the Pantograph partner to explore the death of Cullen Hedrick and the controversial murder law used to charge his girlfriend. The Bloomington City Council has been weighing a welcoming city ordinance for 16 months. Ward 6 Alderman Karen Schmidt talks with Charlie Schlenker about when and if the council will vote on a measure offering some protections for undocumented immigrants. And how will tax issues play out during the next election cycle? Reporters on the IPR Politics Roundtable have some thoughts. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 9th, 2016. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In the last few years, McLean County leaders have tried to smooth the choppy intersection between the criminal justice system and those who live with mental illness. One recent Bloomington murder case shows what's at stake and what happens when those fighting mental illness lose that fight. In a first-time partnership, GLT and the Pantograph peel back the layers about what happened on a Saturday afternoon in early December and how a controversial part of Illinois' murder statute is being applied to this case. GLT's Ryan Denham and the co-reporter for the Pantograph talk about the case.
I remember when this first happened. It was on a Saturday afternoon, December 2nd, 2017, broad daylight. A police in the coroner's office sent out a press release to the media saying that, you know, someone was killed in a stabbing, some sort of incident at a trailer park. Murder cases aren't too common here in Bloomington Normal, but a street fight in the middle of a trailer park, our tendency is probably to discount that as not especially newsworthy. But the story gets more complicated. Edith Brady Lunny of the Pantograph, what were your first impressions of what happened?
The thing that stood out to me, I think, about this incident was, number one, the fact that a machete was used. We have a lot of typical stabbing cases in the Twin Cities. They happen pretty commonly. It's rare that you would see a machete used in a case. And to me, that stood out as something that made the person carrying that weapon someone that I wanted to know more about.
Then the girlfriend, Brittany Mikesell, is charged with murder. A 23-year-old, she went to the trailer park with her 21-year-old boyfriend, Cullen Hedrick, that day. Looking for trouble, they had a machete, he was wearing a bandana mask, and they run into someone, and Cullen, the boyfriend, is killed.
Yes, about a month later, Brittany is charged with murder, and the state charges her under a controversial state law called felony murder. And under that law, you can be charged with murder even if you were not the person that actually caused the injury that caused that person to die. Just your being at that place when the death occurred is enough to get you charged with the murder. And that's what happened in this case.
That's when I realized there may be more to the story. And that's when Brittany's mother reaches out to GLT over Facebook. She leaves a comment on our Facebook page saying essentially that Brittany has some mental health issues and that was maybe a contributing factor to what happened at the trailer park that day. Edith, you and I have spent the last few weeks looking into Brittany and Cullen's histories, their childhoods. We've read over a ton of documents, DCFS records, police reports, their court cases. We've interviewed more than a dozen people. Edith, what's your take now on these two young people?
I think the thing that stands out to me is they each had their own baggage that contained a lot of serious mental health issues. They both came from backgrounds of violence in their families. There was DCS involvement in their lives as children. So they had some very bad things in common that made them both vulnerable and in need of serious help that they clearly were not getting. So when you put those two people together at the same time and place, they were like a powder keg.
The fatal trip to the Cardinal Ridge Trailer Park on December 2nd, 2017 was years in the making for Brittany and Colin. We've learned a lot about their childhoods. As a girl, Brittany played basketball and volleyball. She went to church camp every year. The downward spiral in her behavior began around the time she went to high school, which she never finished. She threatened suicide in her early teens, and her mother, Melody Justice from Downs, says that's when she was hospitalized for the first of many times.
They suspected borderline personality disorder from the beginning. I think we had 23 hospitalizations in 2 years. But the thing is you can't diagnose somebody with that until they're 18. Then, they'd be bipolar because it's quite similar. Then ADHD.
Then her legal problems begin. Around age 20, she resisted arrest and served 40 days in jail after failing her probation. Her stepfather, John Day from Downs, says she really never got back on track after slipping in high school.
I guess, I'm a firm believer you are a product of your environment. I think she was just in a bad environment.
And then in 2016 or so, she starts dating Cullen Hedrick, a troubled young person in his own right.
Cullen's childhood is also marked with violence. That's according to records that we saw from the Department of Children and Family Services. And those records show Cullen witnessed domestic violence as a child, and he allegedly pulled a knife on his mother and threatened to kill her. They show Cullen was diagnosed with schizophrenia. His mother told police after his death that his behavior turned darker and more aggressive. And he spent his 18th birthday at a juvenile detention center. DCFS, in their reports, say that the combination of mental illness and other challenges faced by Cullen and Brittany made their future a very risky proposition, according to the child welfare staff that put together those DCFS reports. Here's a quote from one of those reports, quote, "There appears to be a significant risk for future violence in their relationship."
At one point in October 2016, Brittany secured an order of protection against her boyfriend. But then, months later, she was pregnant. Records show Cullen was arrested and jailed 3 times during her pregnancy. And the McLean County Jail is accustomed to frequent flyers like Cullen, those with mental health issues who return again and again. A quarter of all inmates self-report some history of mental health treatment and receive subsequent assistance. That's according to Jacqueline Mathias, an inmate specialist and counselor at the jail.
We get everything. You can get everything from generalized anxiety, just more anxious, a little bit more nervous about things going on, some minor depression, situational depression, things like that, all the way up to active psychosis, active delusions, people hearing voices, people seeing things, believing things, telling you an entire story they believe that you know isn't possible. It's anything. We see everything that comes in.
Brittany's mom, Melody Justice, says it was hard to keep her in treatment long enough to really make a difference. That's something we also heard from her stepdad, John Day.
No sooner would she get out of one, for whatever reason it may be, for completing what they wanted, telling them what they wanted, or getting kicked off, or stealing something, or doing something. The minute she got out, she was right back to her old stuff. You know, it just seemed like nothing that we did or anybody did or tried was doing anything for her. You know, it's like almost like she didn't want no help.
When Cullen was in jail in mid-2017, Brittany's life seemed to stabilize a bit. Family says she had a gender reveal party for the baby and was getting excited to be a mother. But then Cullen is released from jail June 7th, 2017. Here is Brittany's stepfather again.
Maybe what drew them together was the fact that they both had similar problems.
They had a baby girl who was born on July 4th, 2017. And DCFS records show the next day a nurse at the hospital overheard an agitated Cullen reference the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting and his ability to get a gun despite having a mental illness. And this really concerned the hospital officials, and they recorded that in their records, and they also made a hotline call to DCFS to report that behavior. So DCFS records show the state put the baby into protective custody after medical staff reported signs of alcohol and marijuana in the baby's system. So the placement of the baby with Brittany's aunt furthered splintered an already divided family. For the next 5 months, the parents are granted supervised visitation with their child.
Colin was arrested again September 12th on a warrant. During booking, he struck a guard at the jail and served 46 more days in jail. He was released November 26, 2017. That's the week he's killed. Edith, you spoke to Brittany's aunt, Kathleen Miller, who lives in northern Illinois. She's adopted the baby. What does she say?
Kathleen Miller said that she stepped up right away and offered to take the baby as a foster parent. The concerns about Brittany's behavior and Cullen's ability to be a father were something that the family had on their radar for quite a long time. So she said that the two of them together were not a good mix, and certainly not any kind of a stable relationship that you would want for raising a baby. She said they were doing numerous things together. One was pressuring the other, and that's why she stepped in and thought it'd be best if she took the baby, at least while they sorted things out to see if they could go to services and become good parents.
The week leading up to Colin's death is pretty tumultuous for the couple. Colin gets out of jail on a Sunday. 2 days later, they're together, and Brittany allegedly pepper sprays a woman near a Normal trailer park. Police reports show they're also suspected of beating a man with a baseball bat at a separate trailer park in Normal. Family tells police that they suspect the couple is dealing drugs.
That's right. The last few days were not a good period of time but for Cullen and for Brittany. The night before this incident happened at the trailer park, they stayed up until 4 a.m. They were talking about the relationship and her withdrawal issues from the drug Spice, which is a mind-altering synthetic drug. And Brittany later tells police she was, quote, freaking out like a demon that night. And Hedrick was reading the Bible to her, maybe trying to calm her down.
Spice is something we heard over and over again reporting this story. It was found on Brittany after Colin's death, and it shows up on a search warrant as prosecutors filed charges. Jackie Mathias, the woman who works with inmates at the jail who have mental health and substance abuse issues, told us they're seeing Spice show up more and more, too.
Lately, we've seen a lot of drug-induced psychosis with Spice, particularly. If they've been doing Spice for several days, they'll come in and we kind of have to wait out and figure out, is this a mental health issue, meaning they have a long history, or is this something that was triggered by drug use?
Authorities have not publicly disclosed why they think the couple went to 24th Street in the Cardinal Ridge Trailer Park with their masks, that machete, pepper spray, in broad daylight on a Saturday afternoon. Police reports we've obtained reveal the couple was looking for an acquaintance who briefly lived with Brittany while Cullen was jailed. So what does Brittany tell the police?
Well, during her interview after the incident happened, and Brittany was brought into the Bloomington Police Department, and she told them the whole point of this incident was to find that person and fight him for the disrespect he showed toward her and Cullen. And that's according to a detective's narrative of his interview with Brittany.
Hours before Cullen's death, police reports show they confront that person in Hayworth, but he gets away. They chase him back to Bloomington on US 51, arriving at the trailer park. But instead of confronting their target, they come across this other guy, Rodney Doherty, and it's a fatal mistake.
In the hours after Cullen's death, police were trying to sort out all these conflicting statements about what happened on 24th Street. Rodney's face was still burning from the pepper spray. It told police the couple attacked him without provocation after he just pulled up to a trailer to see a buddy. Rodney says it was self-defense, and he didn't know the couple who attacked him. Police believed him and allowed him to go.
Brittany tells police that Rodney tried to run over Colin with his car, but police reports show Brittany is a bit of an unreliable narrator at this point. She's distraught. She tries to kill herself several times in police custody, and she's still potentially under the effects of spice, which is found in her bra. Neighbors told reporters they suspect drugs played some role in bringing Colin and Brittany to the trailer park that day. Police found drug paraphernalia and spice on them. Neighbors in Cardinal Ridge are used to seeing the police. Edith, you and I spent a day wandering around talking to neighbors. What struck you about their comments?
The thing that struck me about the trailer park in general was the transient nature of the entire neighborhood. There were a lot of piles of personal possessions that we would see stacked up in front of a lot of the mobile homes, which leads you to believe that people come and go a lot there. And neighbors we talked to were concerned about that. They didn't really feel like they knew who their neighbors were anymore. And families that were there and had been there for quite a while and were just trying to raise their children there were very concerned with what they were seeing. And there was just a feeling in general that there was some illegal activity going on, most of it related to drug transactions. And then when this happened, it really shook several families to the core, and they expressed to us that they were getting out because it was just not the place that they wanted to be to raise a family.
And we spoke to Sandy Zong, who lives just like one street over from where this happened. She plans to leave Cardinal Ridge, too.
It's sad, but it's not a good place. For the people that have been here for years, you know, it's sad what it's turned into.
For now, Brittany's being held at the McLean County Jail on $2 million bond. 2 weeks ago, she agreed to terminate her custody rights to her 8-month-old daughter.
Cullen is buried at Pleasant Grove Cemetery in Downs, and his family declined repeated requests from us for an interview for this story.
That's Edith Brady Lunny of the Pantograph reporting with GLT's Ryan Denham. Coming up during Sound Ideas, a closer look at the controversial legal concept being used against Brittany Mikesell and why the defense thinks this is such an unusual case. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from SEFCU, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFCU even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. GLT's Ryan Denham and the Pantograph's Edith Brady Lunny pick up their story with Cullen Hedrick killed, Brittany Mikesell charged with his murder, and their baby in the adoptive hands of a relative.
The other side of their story is the legal case against Brittany. The charge against Brittany is based on a controversial provision of Illinois' murder statute. It allows for a person to be charged with murder if someone dies while they're committing a forcible felony, such as a robbery. It's called felony murder. In Brittany's case, she's charged with murder because her boyfriend, Colin Hedrick, died while she was allegedly committing mob action in a South Bloomington trailer park. Authorities say a third person, Rodney Doherty, actually stabbed Colin in self-defense. Yet Brittany is the one charged with murder. Edith, what do lawyers say about this law?
Well, there is skepticism in the legal community, particularly among defense lawyers, about the felony murder law. Some states have curtailed its use, and high-profile cases have been overturned in Indiana and Massachusetts. Critics of the law's application in juvenile cases successfully won a commuted sentence in 2017 for a teenager convicted of felony murder in Ogle County, right here in Illinois. We spoke to David Rumley, a Bloomington defense attorney who's not involved in this case.
There's also, in the legal field, a lot of skepticism about how beneficial the rule is. Okay? Typically, prosecutors like it and everyone else doesn't. But there's some scholarship on it, too. There's a lot of articles. And the articles find it hard to justify, and just from a logical standpoint.
And that skepticism is twofold. Rumley says that from from a logical standpoint, the law runs counter to the legal system's doctrine of holding people responsible for their own bad actions. It also has questionable deterrence effectiveness because a person committing a lesser crime might not expect to be charged with murder.
To the extent the law surprises people, you can say that's a failure, because what we want to do is to have them contemplate the law and conform their actions before anything like this happens. And when something comes out of left field, where's the deterrent effect of the law? It's purely punishment at that point.
McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers defended his office's use of the law. Here's how he explains it.
Two guys, and one of them says, hey, we're going to go rob a bank. So they go, and one of them stays in the car. The other one goes in to rob the bank. But in the process of that, let's say there's a security guard or a police officer shows up and shoots the guy robbing the bank, a death has occurred in the process of committing a robbery. Now the getaway driver can be charged for their partner's death. So felony murder is basically if you participate in a forcible felony and it causes someone's death, that falls under paragraph 3 of the homicide statute.
So in Brittany's case, she and Colin went to the trailer park armed with a machete and pepper spray. Authorities say they were there to confront someone. Before that confrontation took place, they encountered this other guy, Rodney Doherty, and he ends up stabbing Cullen in self-defense. Cullen dies at the emergency room, and prosecutors will have to prove Brittany's conduct during their confrontation with Rodney is what led to Cullen's death.
There are still several unknowns that may come out should this case go to trial. Was Brittany the aggressor in Cullen's final moments? Why did their confrontation with this stranger turn violent so suddenly? We spoke to Brittany's public defenders last week. They say it's an unusual case and that it's a stretch by the state to go with felony murder. And the stakes are high. A person who's convicted of felony murder faces 20 to 60 years in prison. McLean County actually has two felony murder cases pending. Edith, what's the other one?
So the other one was filed in 2016 against Danny Smith of Peoria. He's accused of being responsible for the death of Mons Bryant. Mons suffered a serious head injury when he fell during a break-in by Smith. Bryant was kidnapped along with his stepfather and died the following day at a Peoria hospital. Smith faces murder charges in Bryant's death, even though Bryant's injuries from the fall are believed to be the cause of death. And Chambers says there is a deterrent effect in the felony murder law.
Again, not specifically talking about this case. I think it drives home the seriousness of what can happen. It is a reminder to people that if you engage in dangerous activities, you can end up having some pretty tragic results.
Edith, what do people who know Brittany and Cullen say about this murder charge? The fact that she wasn't just charged with mob action, but with murder.
The people that are closest to Brittany have their differences on many things. But one thing that they do seem to come together on is the fact that they believe Brittany should pay some price for what happened to Cullen. Everybody doesn't agree that she should be charged with murder because when it comes down to it, it was declared a self-defense case. But they do believe that her past conduct and the things that she maybe has gotten away with in her past is reason enough to hold her accountable, and accountable in a very serious way for Cullen's death.
Brittany's mom, Melody Justice, is adamant. She says the felony murder charge is unfair. She thinks that's especially true given Brittany and Cullen's relationship, and because Brittany was bipolar and had other mental health issues.
She tried to save his life. She was his best chance at life. She drove him to the hospital. Okay, now, if he's out there with a machete going after somebody, what do you think he's doing with that machete in the car? You know, I just don't, you know, the law in general, it doesn't account for all these outside outliers that, you know, could be involved. And charging her for all these mob action and all this stuff, I don't think that she was even aware that, you know, I mean, she isn't aware. She can't even pay her own bills.
That's Melody Justice, the mother of Brittany Mikesell, who faces a felony murder charge in the death of her boyfriend, Colin Hedrick. For Edith Brady Lenny of the Pantograph, I'm Ryan Denham.
This story was jointly reported by GLT and the Pantograph, first for our two newsrooms. You can go deeper into Brittany and Cullen's stories on our website, WGLT.org, with court documents, photos, and more. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. A welcoming city ordinance has been a topic of debate for some 16 months in the city of Bloomington. Ward 6 Alderman Karen Schmidt authored an alderman's request to kick off that discussion all those months ago. Since then, there has been a resolution that a community coalition didn't like, a draft ordinance that aldermen didn't like, a hiatus while everyone waited for Governor Rauner to decide on the State Trust Act, a second draft ordinance that mirrored state law that the coalition didn't like, and now a third draft ordinance from the Keep Families Together coalition. Alderman asked that draft be pulled from a council agenda earlier this year. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Alderman Schmidt about why aldermen are coming forward now when they have not been willing to go in-depth publicly for some months.
First of all, I think it's important to set the stage of the environment that we're in right now. It's a lot of turmoil and chaos and uncertainty for immigrants in our country, and we have to acknowledge that. And I also know and have observed that some people are emboldened to express their anger and fear sometimes of immigrants. So we have a lot of people in our community that are called to help and to support them, and that's the environment that we're in. I'm really recognizing, and especially on behalf of the people who care deeply about this issue, that the community isn't getting all the facts, and it's much more complicated than an ordinance is a great idea or the ordinance is a terrible idea. So it's not a binary, have an ordinance or don't have an ordinance. Some of the conversation has turned to, in some cases, personal attacks against people on the council, which I think is very unfortunate. And that tells me that we're not in a space anymore where we can have a substantial and meaningful dialogue about what does it mean to be a welcoming community. So I think we need to take this out of that binary kind of situation, that kind of space for a while, and give ourselves an opportunity to assert what our community values are. I'm not interested in attacking anyone, but what I am interested in and I'm committed to is to figure out how we can have a critical conversation and come to some common understanding about what does it mean to be a welcoming community in Bloomington and Normal and in our county.
You've emphasized welcoming community as opposed to welcoming city. The two are distinct and different. We had a while ago a retired Illinois State University professor Bob Bradley talk about what other communities have done to have this broader, more grassroots, sustained effort at welcoming community, which does not necessarily include a welcoming city ordinance.
Right.
However, the welcoming city ordinance is what's coming before you. Does that distinction that you're making indicate that you are supporting or not supporting a welcoming city ordinance?
At this point, I'm not supportive of the welcoming city ordinance, particularly the third one that has come our way. As I read it, I think it is very limiting. What I think we have to have in place before we seriously would consider a welcoming city ordinance is the kind of what I call infrastructure in the community to make sure that we're not creating more problems for the people that we're trying to help.
What does the third ordinance have that the second ordinance did not?
It allows for the police to talk to ICE and other agencies, as I understand it, in cases of felony sex and labor trafficking. But there's a whole host of Class X felonies that are not listed there, things like kidnapping and armed robbery, you know, things that you would expect that police would be doing their due diligence to try to, you know, work with whomever is involved in that. So I certainly heard concerns raised about that.
When the five aldermen did a message to the city manager asking to pull the second draft from the February agenda, why was that?
Well, I can't speak for the other aldermen, and I think there may have been five different versions of, you know, everybody had their own rationale for why they did that. For me, I was seeing very clearly that any time you mention the Welcoming City Ordinance, a lot of people are leaping immediately to Sanctuary City. And with that comes a lot of anger and misunderstanding. And if we don't, I have been asking, as have other aldermen for some time now, to have a good, robust community conversation about all the things that we do in this community that work and where we need to do better. And that, to me, is a pathway towards talking about any kind of an ordinance. And if we don't lay that groundwork, I think we are going to be setting this community up for even more divisiveness, and I don't want that to happen. I can say that a typical conversation, I've just had two in the last 3 days of people calling me up and saying, I'm hearing more about this Welcoming City Ordinance. I don't want to be a sanctuary city. So they're making this leap from one thing to another thing. And I think if you follow what's going on in states like California, which is a sanctuary state, the fallout of that is that ICE is taking a lot of measures on its own. And it's also emboldening people to turn in people that they are suspicious of. And I don't think that that's what this community is all about. This is a very loving, supportive community. And I want to put tools in people's hands so that when they encounter hostility or misinformation, that we have a common language where we can support one another.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Alderman Karen Schmidt about the Welcoming City Ordinance and other issues. The Welcoming City Ordinance, though, and the kind of process you're describing can happen in a dual-track fashion.
They certainly can. I was really interested to be introduced to the concept of Welcoming America by Bob Bradley, and I've been doing quite a bit of reading about that, and I think that in many ways that's our map towards developing these conversations and really having developing the kinds of support systems that we need. I look at Welcoming Dayton, which is often held up as the epitome of what a Welcoming America community is, and there are ordinances in there that speak to police and judiciary. And that's a role that the municipality can play, but there are many other areas in economic development within the faith community through education where it becomes part of a bigger whole and becomes much more meaningful.
Since those two processes can happen at the same time, why does it take 16 months to deal with an ordinance issue, up or down, one way or the other?
Well, I think that some of us have been asking pretty regularly to have that open conversation throughout the community, and we really haven't had that opportunity. And I think that anyone who stuck it out through our last council meeting at the end of five long hours will have heard me and Scott Black and others say, you know, we have to have this conversation. We're being asked in a very passionate way to have this conversation. And we cannot simply have an up or down vote on an ordinance and think that we're done with it. I really appreciate the approach that Mayor Coos has taken within his council of saying, you know, if I have a 4-3 vote, I don't know that that's good enough because it's a divisive vote on a divisive issue, and that's not good for the community.
Yeah, the normal council we're hearing is only weeks away, though, from having a vote on it. And so they took it up much later than Bloomington did, mm-hmm. and they seem to be almost ready to act. So if this conversation is so important to have rather than just a policy choice made by elected officials or on top of that, why hasn't it happened before now? Who is responsible for leading that conversation if you are viewing it as a prerequisite for a vote on an ordinance?
I would hope that our mayor would lead that conversation. I have to say, as I think about the other eight other aldermen, there's only a handful where I feel like I have a pretty good idea about what they think, but I don't even know what my colleagues think about this. And so, you know, subsequently, what in the world must Bloomington residents think about what we know? I would imagine within normal, they have just a different culture, and they probably have had a lot more opportunity to communicate and collaborate around an idea. And I'll look forward to seeing what they come up with.
The proponents of the ordinance, though, have said it's been very difficult over many months to get meetings with aldermen. Is that part of the conversation that hasn't happened? And why not, if they've been asking for meetings?
I honestly don't know.
How many meetings have you been asked to have with the proponents from the coalition that is backing
this? I've had meetings with them up until the time that Mayor Renner came back from his leave, and then he said that he would begin to take the lead on this, and that from that time on, I really haven't met with them.
Is it possible to have a vote on an ordinance while you are also advocating for this larger conversation to happen, in your view?
I don't think that there's going to be five or more votes for an ordinance without a much better understanding about what it means and what else we might need to do.
What are the things that you think need to be decided before a vote can happen?
I would very much like us to use some of the tools in the Welcoming America toolbox. Some of those are looking at an inventory of assets, because we do an awful lot of things right here. So let's not tweak the things that we do right. And I think it will also help us understand some of the things that we really need to improve. An example of that might be, like, we could pass a welcoming city ordinance, but what happens if you walk into City Hall and you speak Urdu or German or Spanish or some other language? What are our resources to help people for whom English is not their primary language, to help them set up a business or build a house or engage in some other way in the community? I don't know what kind of structure we have around that. And I think that those are important structures to have.
So those are structures that you view are necessary to have before the city can take a policy statement on such an ordinance?
The ordinance, it speaks to a very specific action, whether the police can talk to ICE or not.
Right.
What I'm talking about is something much, much larger than that. And I'd like to hear, we haven't had the conversation yet even about the third draft of the ordinance. I would like to hear from our police, and I'd actually like to hear from state's attorney about the impact of this on their work.
So who's responsible for driving it? The third draft has been out for a while now. Should the city staff have circulated that for comment? Should the mayor have held a more public venue discussion of it?
I would really like Mayor Renner to have a public conversation to kick this off and to figure this out.
How can the mayor better act then?
Well, I think he heard us at the last meeting that, you know, at least some of us are looking for that conversation. So I hope it shows up on a on an agenda pretty soon, a committee of the whole or otherwise.
In a recent meeting, Alderman Bray, Kim Bray, commented that she thought the mayor's comments and Alderman Burgess's comments were being abusive. What's your view of those comments during that meeting? Both what the mayor and Alderman Burgess were doing in calling for a vote and a process to get to a vote, and Alderman Bray's view that it was their comments were abusive. Let's take the Alderman Burgess's comments and Mayor Renner's recapping the history as he saw it of the issue. Were those appropriate things to happen in that venue? Let's take that first.
I think that Alderman Burgess and the mayor were having a good conversation about where we need to go next and where we've been. And I suspect that Alderman Bray, because that had gone on, that conversation had gone on for a few moments, and it had been at least a five-hour meeting. I imagine Alderman Bray was trying to call this back into a specific action item.
Was her language appropriate? Is that how the kind of thing that should happen at a public meeting?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Regarding the five-hour length of the meeting, maybe that does place it in context of some frustration and fatigue. But a full discussion is going to take time.
Yes, it will.
How should that happen with good relationships among the aldermen?
Well, I think we need to start with a round table understanding of where each of us are on both the ordinance and what, as individuals, we think our obligation might be to supporting the more vulnerable people in our community. And that's a starting point. After that, I think, you know, for me, I would be advocating for using some of the tools from Welcoming America. And I would really like to engage in some open conversation with many of the people who showed up for the vigil and the fast who care very passionately about the immigrant community and want to be engaged and want to figure out a way for them to be involved. So we start with information, respectful information sharing.
And then have a vote after that.
We could.
Or a vote before.
Or at minimum, we have a path forward. Okay. People deserve to know what the path forward is, and we have not articulated that.
What is your understanding of how the immigrant community feels? What have you been hearing from them?
Well, I've personally observed, actually, some disturbing interactions where people have been intimidated or verbally assaulted. I've helped a couple people connect them to police and, helped walk through some of those situations. I've had friends tell me about, again, mostly verbal kinds of, comments and that kind of thing that are anything but welcoming. And that's very, very disturbing to me. I also know, on the other hand, it was slightly more than a year ago that Not in Our Town filled the BCPA with standing room only with people who were coming around our Muslim community. And we need to tap into that power and that passion and give everybody some tools.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlanger. Karen Schmidt, Alderman of the City of Bloomington, is with us. The Welcoming City Ordinance is not the only example of a protracted process. There is the solid waste issue that took some years to bring to a decision point. How can the mechanisms of Bloomington government be made more expeditious?
I think that we need to continue to work on communication among aldermen and make sure that we're all on the same track. I often think about Mayor Smart, knowing that when he was mayor, he never walked into a meeting without pretty much knowing how the vote would go and really understanding where people were and working out some of those questions and differences of opinion, before it became a public conversation. And, you know, I will say again, I don't know what my colleagues necessarily think about welcoming city or welcoming community. So just baseline respectful communication is you know, it's hard work sometimes, but it's worth it.
Returning to your comment about Mayor Kusa's remark about a 4-3 vote not being good enough, sometimes 4-3 votes do happen, though.
Sure.
Can you, in a broad sense, describe when a 4-3 vote is okay and when your example of Mayor Smart's vote wrangling or taking the temperature of the council and smoothing differences behind the scenes is the way to go?
In my council, a 5-4 vote on trash fees, for example, I might be on the losing end, but it wouldn't be the first time and it won't be the last. For other things like the Welcoming City Ordinance, which is the whole issue of immigration right now is so chaotic, we need to be far more deliberative and thoughtful and take some more time. And I think that that's what I and other aldermen have been asking for some time now.
Alderman Karen Schmidt talked with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. The Bloomington City Council and aldermen will vote on the budget tonight, but the Welcoming City Ordinance is not on the agenda. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org. There are all kinds of ways to listen to GLT.
And during this fun drive, you can win one of the newest ways to listen with an Amazon Echo. Hello, I'm Alexa.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. Smart speakers can help with all kinds of things.
Like playing your favorite public radio station.
During this fun drive, you could win one of 10 Echo speakers with my new friend, Alexa.
Mike, we're not friends.
But we are, sort of, right?
Whatever.
Contribute and learn how you can win a smart speaker at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting award-winning actor Frank Ferrante in his acclaimed portrayal of comedian Groucho Marx, Saturday, April 14th. It's an evening of hilarity and audience participation as Ferrante ad-libs throughout in grand Groucho style. Comedy for all ages. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Nobody is waiting for Labor Day and the traditional start to the political campaign season in this election cycle. The Illinois Politics Roundtable deals with a big election issue, taxes. IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey moderates the discussion with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR's Daisy Contreras, and Rick Pearson, a political reporter for the Chicago Tribune.
Well, he talked about tax rates, but he didn't give any, and that's kind of the problem. It's kind of a trick bag of his own making here, where we had basically all of the Democratic candidates for governor came out in support of a progressive income tax. Very few of them even discussed what rates they would apply to income in Illinois. So Pritzker has never said what he believes those progressive scale of rates should be. And still won't say. But in the meantime, he concludes that because of the need to have a constitutional amendment to have a true graduated income tax, because the Constitution mandates a flat income tax, to get a constitutional amendment passed could take what he says is at least 2 years. And in the meantime, he would propose raising the current 4.95% personal income tax rate even higher, coupled with raising deductions and create what he calls an artificial graduated tax.
Yeah, sort of a jerry-rig thing where you'd have you could sort of, it's even though it wouldn't be written into the Constitution, you could give people money back who are on the, what did he say, in the middle class or trying to get into the middle class, I think was the turn of phrase I heard him use.
Right, but when you look at the things that he's talking about, particularly with education funding, boosting education funding, but also wanting to provide property tax relief, and then you're going to talk about deductions that would take away revenue. It would seem to be that this would require a sizable increase in the state income tax. Granted, there would be additional deductions, but again, he won't say. And, you know, we're on the one-year point of the Pritzker campaign. He's now the Democratic nominee. And I think it's going to be one of these repeated situations where he's going to say tax rates need to jump, and reporters are going to consistently say, how high?
Right. And Charlie, I mean, he's asking the voters here to elect him on a raise taxes platform, which is not unheard of in Illinois. Pat Quinn ran on that 4 years ago, but it's not exactly what you expect the typical politician to run on. Are you what do you think about his decision not to give rates here? Is that a shrewd political move, or is it something that's going to continue haunting him?
Well, I think it would be better off for him were he to actually discuss some idea of what the range could be. He could look at one of our neighboring states and say, for example, here's what they do in Wisconsin. And so we would adapt their rates. But he's right. It would take probably 2 years or more because you have to amend the Constitution. It's very unlikely that an amendment will be put before the voters this fall. So that means you're looking at 2020. The deadline for getting amendments on the ballot this November is the first week in May, and I just don't see any action to try and do that. And the rates are important because people need to know. You could structure them however. You could structure them so that everybody gets a tax break except people making $1 million or more. Or you could structure it so that everybody pays a little bit more. And that's where the uncertainty is, and I think that's an issue that he has to address. He has to propose, here is how I would use it. And as I say, there are models out there. All of our neighboring states have graduated income tax rates with the exception of Indiana. And so it wouldn't make us an outlier to have something like that. But I think you do have to do it by constitutional amendment, and I think this notion of increasing deductions or increasing exemptions based on one's income level and try and do a backdoor graduated income tax will be challenged in court and could very well be thrown out.
Brian Mackey moderated the Politics Roundtable with Rick Pearson, Charlie Wheeler, and Daisy Contreras. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find all of our stories and interviews at our website, WGLT.org.